Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Way on down below, looking back at me from a half a life ago, not getting very far.
And welcome back to another wonderful evening of Bucktastic, right here on LA Talk Radio. And you are listening to Writer's Block. I am your host, Jim Christina, and I'm looking at my charming, wonderful, gorgeous host, Bobby Jean Bell, in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Bobby Jean.
Hey, Jim. I really like that we get to see each other. It's just like the old days in the studio. And then, there was Ronan getting us started, you know, just like all those years at LA Talk Radio. Yeah.
Almost 6 years ago.
I know. In another May, right? In May, it'll be six years. Yeah. Yeah. I can't believe it. And what wonderful books we've read and poetry and
tonight,
authors.
No different. As a matter of fact, tonight is kind of special. Because not only is this guy a singer-songwriter, a very good singer-songwriter, but he's also an author. And his book is just, I mean, it's to die for. It is so much fun to read. And I have to say that I haven't read, well, we read good books every single week. I mean, in the last three or four, we've gushed over because they've been so good. But we've never, ever, ever read a book of essays.
No.
And we've never read a book of essays written from a musician that's been on the road.
Mm-hmm.
And what a treat this is. I have to say that having this gentleman on with us tonight is not a dream come true, but I mean, certainly a big part of my past life, what he does for a living. And I didn't have the wherewithal to keep up with it. I did it for years and finally said, I'm tired. But you know, without anything further ado, let's bring him in because he is just the most terrific guy. And I misspelled guy this when I did the Facebook thing. I said terrific gut. So the bookie says, hey, change that T to a Y, would you? I said, yeah, no way. Got that covered. Without any further ado, let's bring on our guest tonight, Mr. Dave Munsick. Dave.
Yeah. Well, good evening, guys.
Not only have I been listening to your music, but your book is so reminiscent of my time up and down the West Coast. As we talked the other night, I mean, from Redwood City all the way up to Vancouver, BC, we played taverns where, I mean, you know, it was like if it was like an exclusive night, they used to have to put signs on the table, shut up. especially in the Pacific Northwest, because they don't. And
no.
You know, it was a lot of fun. I mean, you to try to sing over and play over talking loggers is like it's not a dream come true. But
well, there's got to be some stories in there now.
Well, there's a few, but we won't get into tonight because this is your night. But I do have to say, I wanted to open the show with your song "I Can Fly." Because the lyric of "I Can Fly" is, of course, when you're around, I think I can fly. And I have felt that way on many different occasions, but then I decided it was the tequila, and I gave it up for lunch.
after, and I know some, better than that, Jim.
After some failed takeoffs from tabletops, I decided, no, I can't fly, and I'm not drinking tequila any longer.
You and John Lennon, right?
Yeah. Me and John. Yeah. Tell us about your book, because the title of your book is. This is your cue. Go ahead.
Song Teller, Notes from the Road.
Sure it is. And
notes is kind of a double play on words, you know.
Exactly. And it's a book of essays, short, 2-3 pages, in some cases like a page, or two, I guess, is the longest, the shortest one. And it chronicles the things that have happened to you on the road. And I have to say, when I got to the point where you fell in love with the girl leaning up against the beige wall, and you know what? I had that guitar. I had that Ovation Dreadnought guitar. I loved that instrument. And that was back when Ovation was still brand new. And my
That's
God,
right,
they made
man.
Stuff. They made some gorgeous stuff. And I used that guitar. I got an Alvarez electric acoustic for stage eventually, but I still use that guitar in all our recordings in the studio. And it just sings like a bird. It just sings. I have sent to mine, but it's a gorgeous, gorgeous instrument. It didn't
they really
go cool.
fit. They fit.
Yeah, they do. Actually, they really do. You know, you think that round back is going to be very uncomfortable to hold, but it's really not.
No, and the neck actually, and everything, like in the story, you know.
It actually presents the neck
pretty good better.
I mean, you're playing D35 now. D35, yeah?
Now, no. I got a D28 that I've beat up, and she just kind of waits for me in her little perch. But I've got the one that I baby now is a Collings D41.
Oh, okay.
And that's the one I usually play.
Well, I was talking to Bobby this afternoon, and I said, you know, I sold a Martin guitar to get the Ovation. And it was a double aught 2-1 classical acoustic folk. And the top warped, and it was actually one of Martin's piece of crap guitars. And I bought this Ovation, and I beat that damn guitar to death. I did. I truly did.
They beat up well. They get a lot of character.
And the more you beat them up, the better they sound.
Exactly, and the more stories they can tell, and that's what that story's about, actually. Yeah.
Yep.
The standing Ovation.
Kudos to Ovation guitars. I don't know if anybody from Ovation is listening, but if they are, you make great instruments. So anyway,
talk to
us about these essays that you cut in the pipe, because they're wonderful. They're wonderful stories. There's this, like I said, reminiscent of time I spent on the road, but they're also they're quite from the heart, and they touch you in places you never really thought you could be touched. And I really appreciate your writing, number one, but your stories, number two.
Well, that's about as deep and wide as a compliment that a writer can have, I think. This book was my first break out of the box in writing. That's my first book. I'd written some stories before this time as a newspaper column for our Sheridan Press here in northern Wyoming. And I'd noticed, boy, people really liked those stories, but I had to keep, she wanted them to be 600 words, the editor did. And in my case, she made the special exception to 800. So when I write one, I get them right down to exactly 800 words.
Uh-huh.
And I got the idea when this COVID thing started to hit about a year ago, I'd had a lot of people ask me, you know, you should put those in a book sometime. And I thought, well, what the hell? I'll start. So I went back through a lot of those columns that I'd written, those stories, and kind of got the chains off of them and rewrote, and that's why they're kind of they run 1,000 words up to 2,000, I guess, or pretty short. I guess I can't hold a thought in my head long enough to write any longer than that, but I don't know how these guys write novels and stuff. That's, you know, pretty impressive.
Yeah. You sit down and do it.
I guess
they may be short, Dave, but they're meaty. They're, you know, the book was 85 pages. Jim and I typically read a book a week for this show that could be 250 to more. And we get that done. Yeah. It's not challenging. But your book at 85 took me the same amount of time because I was digesting it. I was going back to the paragraph, you know, at the very beginning. I was
cool.
Your words. I mean, here's just from the very first essay, Ruby with the Red Shoes On. What a great story this is. But you have just some sentences, like a new song, the phone rang out of a silent day. Like, I would, you know, and this is early, you know, you kind of got me in the first couple of sentences of this very first one, where I thought, this is going to be such a road trip. And you take us through the atmosphere, you take us through the West, you describe the way you describe things, a country of wide open opposites where charging rivers lie against sleeping deserts, invisible hot winds scream at snow-capped mountain intruders. I mean, you know, that's not even one full sentence, but we just want to go with you because you describe.
Well, that's very rewarding. That's very rewarding to hear that. And also to hear those words. I haven't read back through that. So in a year or 6 months. you know, I had a good friend of mine, a couple good friends of mine edited for me. And one of my good friends, Janet Hubbard, Janet Hubbard Brown. She's an accomplished author herself. And she was used to editing books kind of by content, and she was a little bit hands off with mine because she said, you know, yours is more like reads more like poetry, and I don't want to have you mess with it. So she gave me some very, very careful and well thought through suggestions. And we kind of kept going back and forth with that a little bit. But by and large, I just kind of kept my words as fresh as when I tried to keep them as fresh as when I wrote them, when I thought about them. And I found out, you know, as a songwriter, I've been a songwriter for, God, you know, most of my life, that with song, you are, you're harnessed and restricted by the guidance of syllable, cadence, rhythm, time, tempo, melody, and you're trying to wed those things together.
Sure.
And boy, when you sit down to write a song or a story, it's almost like you got let out of school early for the summer or something, and you're just running wild. So when I first started to do that, I mean, that was blabbing on 2,000 and 3,000 words of just rubbish. And it was nice to get the editor of the newspaper that I write for to put a limit on me. And it kind of taught me to get down to the point. So I've been to the extremes, and now with this book, I've been able to kind of get back to, okay, take the guts of those stories, those skeletons, and stick the poetry back into them. So I really enjoy doing that.
Well, it shows. It really does. I mean, it's not every musician that, I mean, we all have stories, and it's just as part of being in the life. It's not every musician that wants to take the time to sit down and write them down. And it's even a further musician that wants to sit down and take the time to put them into a book, which I truly, truly do appreciate. And I'm sure most musicians, and most people will. Oh, you're very welcome. I did recently. Well, actually, 2018. I took a bunch of lyrics and poetry that I'd written since 1967 up to 1983 and put them in a book. And it's called "That's All You Get." But that, and there's about half songs and half poetry. And
that's really cool.
Yeah, and people seem to like it. I mean, it got good reviews.
Right.
So.
Well, you know, instead of having them live in a basket or a box someplace on legal pads.
A wooden chest underneath the bed, yeah.
Exactly. They don't do much good.
No.
They don't do anybody much good that way.
No.
It's kind of like finding arrowheads, you know. They're get some beauty. Get somebody to look at it. Get somebody to appreciate it. Bring a little bit of beauty into the world, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it's at.
Right, exactly.
I firmly believe that.
And your stories of, I mean, your story of the black tie dinner, your black tie affair, and what a great story. And the story when you went into church with the guy, and you tell him, well, you go ahead and start your song, and I'll come in on my fiddle. And he said, I didn't know you could play fiddle. So.
Yeah. You know, I think. My style, what's kind of evolved into my style, I really kind of took some of that from a writer who just passed away a month ago. His name was Joseph Brown. He went under the name JPS Brown, and he was a cowboy here in southern Arizona who worked on both sides of the border all his life. And he ended up being broke back in the 60s, and his uncle down in Nogales on the border fronted him a big wad of bills and told him, you know what, I need rodeo cattle. I need steers with horns on them, and I'll pay you such and such, you know, $100 a head or $50 a head. And so he rode his horse, his big sorrel horse, all the way down through the Sierra Madre in Mexico on the Chihuahua and Sonora border, and wrote stories about the people that he met on that on that huge trip, and buying 1, 2, 3 steers at a time from people. And anyhow, I went over to his house a few years ago, found him, tracked him down. And his style was to start every chapter with a little sub paragraph that would explain, say, a Mexican term or a tradition or a custom or something that people wouldn't really understand. And I asked him about that, and he said, you know, it's like working cattle. Let them get away from you for a little while just so they can show you a little style. And it's kind of like that. You're showing that little style in the beginning, and I like to show a little of that style in my opening paragraph, and then the story develops, the characters get developed, and then as the story closes, I like to circle back and hit that first idea again and kind of solve the problem, if you will, or bring it to a circle.
And you do that.
Moral or something like that.
Brilliant. Yeah, you do that brilliantly.
You do that very well. We have to take a break right now, but Dave, don't go away if you wouldn't mind. Please stay with
us.
I'll
be right here.
And okay, then. And we're going to take a real quick break, and we'll be right back. This is LA Talk Radio. You're listening to The Writer's Block, and we'll be right back right after this word from LA Talk Radio. And then, Ronan, if you wouldn't mind, let's bring it back in with a little more of Mr. Munsick.
Jim Christina here for LA Talk Radio. And if you've ever thought that you could be a radio host, well, now is certainly your opportunity. Go to www.latalkradio.com, find the link that says be a host, and follow the instructions. You know, everybody's got something to say. And if you've got a show that you think needs to be heard, how about you link up with us? Because we've got 50-minute shows available every day of the week, plus Sundays. So how about giving us a try? That's latalkradio.com. And listen every Thursday, 6 p.m. Pacific, for the Writer's Block, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Left the bighorn back behind me. Told old Skip to hold the mail. Said when he asked, when I'd be coming back.
And it is now 6:19. We are back with our guest, Mr. Dave Muncik. And if you want to call and talk to Dave, of course, the number here in the studio is 323-203-0815. Again, that number is 323-203-0815. And if you want to call and talk to Dave, you can. And right now, Bobby Jean, I believe you're right in the middle of a question before I cut you off with the commercial.
Oh, well, Dave, I guess if I have a question besides just gushing over this book, I believe kind of as a songwriter, you know, the songs kind of choose you. I think you said that in one of these stories, essays. And I wondered with these, this collection, some of them, they're so rich, but they're based on a very simple experience that most of us maybe wouldn't even know was noteworthy. How did these reveal themselves to you?
That is a very insightful question, Bobby Jean. No wonder you do this for a living, and I don't.
Do we make money at this, Jim? No, we do this out of love.
I don't know. Yeah. You know, I would like to think that is the case, that that maybe everybody, I don't know if I'm special about that or not, but there are, if you stop and you think about things and the meaning for things, and why things happen, you can get yourself into all kinds of little poetic circles and cycles. But, you know, to give a simple example, maybe you're thinking of a friend and then they call you on the phone, or you have a dream about something and then experience it the next day. You know, there's kind of magic that's popping around us all the time, and we're born to see it, and we kind of train ourselves not to see it so we can pay the bills and kind of handle everything through the day. But if we can kind of rip that little veil away, boy, you know, there's lessons to learn from everybody, everything's got a story, and it's just kind of our responsibility, or our job, that's a better word for that, to tell what that story is and why that story matters. So that might not have answered your question, but came close.
Well, you gave us a collection where I think each person will respond differently, but there's opportunities to laugh and to have a broken heart and to rejoice. And so the collection, I think, takes us through what it is to be human. My favorites is that simple story about you and your son and the fiddle contest.
Oh,
and,
wow.
You describe, cool. You know, that ride home. You want to Do you want to read any? I would love to hear some of these things in your voice, but I don't know if you have the book there and if you are, you know, be comfortable.
I do have it. Why don't you ask me for what you would like me to read, and I would gladly do that.
Well,
there you go.
Well, we might have to have him do the ovation one, Jim, because he described
it. At least the first part of it. We had Tom last week reading some of his cowboy poetry. And,
right. Yeah. He's excellent.
He's so good. And you know, it a lot of his stuff hits home, especially for old horsemen and stuff too. So, I mean, this certainly does hit home for me as well. So yes, can you just open with the old ovation and just kind of start that story, because that is such a great story.
Because we talked about that and it's fabulous.
Well, I'm looking at page 73 here, and on the top is a sketch by my good friend, Joel Osland, a pretty high powered Western artist, of a horse with a diamond hitch thrown over his back with a pack mani cover, a tarp over that pack. And under it, you can just barely see the outline of a guitar. And that guitar is on the mountain going into the hills. So, the standing ovation. The image of a beautiful body is traditionally thought to be one that has not been marred by the hazards of living. A newborn baby or an airbrushed model may project perfection to the beholder, but their appearance reflects the image of a life that has neither been lived or one that has yet to be lived. A truly beautiful life is one that has been experienced to its fullest in a manner that has in some way made the journey smoother for someone else. The quality of this life can be measured not by the perfection that it boasts, but by the scars that it wears. Back in one of my other lives, I was for a while what might be termed a down and outer. Getting paid by night for the work that I did by day was just barely keeping me even with the weekly rent I was paying on my one room in a shady flop house. Nonetheless, I was managing to keep a good attitude in spite of my Spartan existence. I had a burning desire for only one thing back then, and it was the one thing that I didn't have. I first saw her on a Saturday, leaning against the wall of a crosstown music shop where I had walked that morning. I'd never seen anything quite like her before. I was instantly smitten by her long, lean body, her teak-colored skin, and the exotic material she was dressed in. The plain ivory-colored wall she leaned against accentuated her natural beauty, and no matter how hard I tried to be polite, I couldn't quite keep my eyes off her. When I finally got up the courage to reach my hand out to her, she offered me no resistance. I was hooked. After all, it doesn't take much to make an 18-year-old boy fall in love. "What kind of guitar is that?" I asked the store owner. "That's an Ovation Balladeer, son. You like it? Got a pretty nice feeling neck, doesn't it? Here, you need to play it to actually understand it." He handed me the guitar, and I hit an open G chord, let it ring, adjusted the tuning pegs a little, and began to show off for her the best way that I could at the time. I picked a little Lester Flatt bluegrass lick and some Doc Watson bass runs. She answered back in a voice that was just as pretty as she looked. Regretfully, I handed the guitar back to the salesman. "What's the matter, son? Don't you like it?" I didn't answer. My discreet peek at her price tag had taken away most of the rest of what I had to say. I still remember the number, $229. At a time when gas was 50 cents a gallon and wages like I was making added up to $15 a day. I turned around, left the store, and walked out to begin a new life dedicated to adding $209 to the $20 bill I already had in my pocket. The more time that went by, the more jealous I became at the thought of her being taken by another in my absence. I would rush over to see her every Saturday morning, run my hands up and down her neck, have little talks with her about the life we would share together, and leave the store heartsick without her. Like a guy saving up for his wedding, I began to put $10 back from each one of my meager paychecks and into a growing stack of bills that I kept rolled up inside an old wool sock. In that sock lay my future. I remember well the contrast between my warm sense of relief each time I saw her standing there and the growing coldness of the salesman who was getting to know me all too well. On one fine day in May, though, I walked into the music store with a song in my head and that sock in my pocket. I took those bills, pressed them down on the counter with a palm of my hand, announcing that I wanted that Balladeer demo behind the counter. The salesman was so shocked that he offered to get me a brand new one that was still in the box for the same price, but I stayed true to my promise and ended that era of my life by walking out of the store with my new bride, swaddled in the only case that I could afford at the time, a pink blanket from the Salvation Army.
I love it!
With that, we both hit the long open road.
Oh, my God.
I named... Do you want me to keep going or not?
Oh, yeah. What'd you name her? What did you name her?
I named her Jezebel.
Jezebel, yeah.
Mine, Jezebel.
Mine was Griselda.
Oh, Jesus. Maybe they were sisters or something.
And you know, the truth is, if you don't name them, you don't play them.
Really?
Yeah.
I think that every musician has the same thing. If you don't name your guitar, you don't play it.
Well, they're not really part of your family till they got a name. It's like having our second son when he was born. He was called Baby Munsick for a
there
couple days till he earned his name.
You're not mine until you have a name.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
Hey, tough Dave. We're going to be right back with you. Right now, we're going to have another quick break, and it's going to be. Well, you're listening, of course, to LA Talk Radio. This is the Writer's Block. We'll be having a real quick recorded break from out west and followed quickly by another Mr. Munsick music. So, Ronan, please.
Here at the Out West Shop, we're passionate about the American West, the truth and the myth. We're purveyors of fine Western goods. We scout for unique and distinctive apparel, accessories, home decor, and general merchandise that are a reflection of the Western lifestyle. We hunt for unique artisans and craftsmen who are inspired to create decorative art you can wear based on their own love for the story of the West. We round it up and bring it to you. Check out OutWestShop.com when you need anything Western.
We are back with our guest tonight, Mr. Dave Munsick, and of course, Bobby Jean Bell. And if you want to call and talk to Dave tonight, the number in the studio here is 323-203-0815. And we'll be actually talk about a little bit about Dave's music, because I believe that was that song was Tequila, if I'm not mistaken. Is it not, Dave?
Yes, sir. Yep. Right on.
I have had many horses, and I have had many horses' names, but I have never named one Tequila.
Well, the reason for that name is that sucker, he came out of Mexico, and he was golden in color and smooth going down.
Oh.
And,
that was the trick there. You could look at him head on and miss him. He was so skinny.
Oh, he was one of those Mexican horses, yeah.
He was a Mexican pony, yeah. And he, a friend of mine, made a deal. He was going to make all this money by bringing these horses. He got them for $70 or something down there in Sonora, and brought them up to northern Wyoming, which is big horse country where we live. And the guy who, and he had a little horse sale with these horses, and everybody just kind of laughed at him. And I was up on the mountain on a pack trip with a friend of mine, and we were drinking whiskey, sitting around the fire and remembering that. That was way back in the 80s, I guess. And I said, who the hell would have actually bought one of those horses? And it got real silent real quick. I did. I got one of them. And I said, you're kidding me, would you? Well, he bought this horse, this little tequila horse, for the owner of this ranch that he worked on. And that owner of the ranch is one of the wealthiest guys in the United States. He has broken and trained 1,000 thoroughbred horses. He's a big polo guy. And when he took a look at that horse, he said, you know what he said. You're never going to catch me up there.
Yeah, I'm never going to ride that horse.
No, never going to ride that horse. And he worked on him for a few nights down at the corral with a little bit of liquor and a little bit of sweet talk. And he finally got this owner of the ranch on him, and he fell in love with that little horse. And the next thing you know, he hauled that horse back to his big thoroughbred farm in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and had a stall for him and hired little girls to brush him and dump grain in a in a pan for him the rest of his life. So I like to tell people, you know, that little horse, he was raised out on mesquite, beans, and rust, and he never did get a chance to grow very big because his mother didn't have any milk, and he didn't have any grass to eat.
Right.
And he woke up one day freezing his butt up off in northern Wyoming. He was honest as hell. He took this guy for a ride, and the next thing he woke up, and he felt like he'd gone to heaven, man. He's back with little girls massaging him every day of his life. So it's kind of a,
that's a great story.
From rags to riches. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great, I mean, there's, I've known story. Only two Mexican horses like that. And both of them always seem so thankful and grateful when they got to eat. Because they go out there and eat scrub. They eat scrub. That's what they have.
Oh, yeah. Exactly.
There's no grass. There's no nothing. They eat junipers. They eat, pepper trees.
Sagebrush, yeah.
They love they pepper got. Trees. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I had an Arab, not Arab, a quarter Morgan mix. His name was Bandit, and he used to love pepper trees. He would stand underneath them and munch on them for hours.
Yeah.
And I always thought he was going to make him sick, but it never did. Never did.
Yeah. It probably wasn't too good on the pepper trees, but.
No. Well, that's okay. You need a trimming anyway. So, What got you into music? And this is a question that I ask a lot of musicians, because it takes a certain person to not only write music but play it and play it in front of people. That's like putting yourself in ninth grade in a play in front of the entire student body. I've been there too.
That guy was not me. That was not me. The ninth grade in front of the whole. I did that. Oh boy, yeah. That's a great question. There's a transition there. You know, I was into music since I've got a memory. My first memory. of music is me sitting on a piano bench with my mom, who was very musical, with my little legs sticking straight out because they couldn't bend yet when you're that age.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
And singing harmony with her and just learning music by the pounding of the bass and the rhythm in the right hand and the singing.
Exactly.
And that, so it was second nature to me. And then you've got a, you know, let's face it, you've got a gift. I mean, some people can just feel it. You can feel rhythm. You can feel the big picture of music. You start to develop a love of melody. And then you get a little bit older than that, and you start realizing what melody does to enhance lyrics and what lyrics do to enhance melody. I got into jazz when I was a teenager, then kind of into the folk and country scene. Played for myself a lot, played in bands when I was about 15,
Are you my brother? We did the same thing.
Same kind of thing. I taught myself fiddle when I was 21. That's what I wanted to do. And I would just play all the time. And I moved from New Mexico up to Wyoming in 1982 and joined a band up there. And we played for a long time, the Powder River Boys up there. And then I started to write. I really didn't start to write till the 90s.
Uh-huh.
And got a lot of enjoyment, a lot of satisfaction out of doing that. So I've never really quit.
When you write a song, I don't know if I've ever asked this. Well, we don't have that many musicians on. I know how I do it, but my band, I always wrote for my lead singer, David Audie, because he had the sound that our band mm-hmm. was. We were an acoustic vocal band. I mean, we did two, three mm-hmm. part harmonies and harmonized guitar parts as well, which is a little difficult to do. But we had a lot of
arranging. Yeah.
Oh boy. But I used to write for David's voice. And when you sit down and write a song, do you write it for your voice or just anybody who can sing it?
Almost always for my voice. There's been a few times I've written with somebody else in mind. Mm-hmm. And I can just hear that, whether they've heard it. You know, one of those songs on that CD that I sent you, I like to say, I tell people, you know, I wrote this song here for Merle Haggard, and everybody gets real quiet and they go, oh, that's awesome. And what I say then is, well, I did. He just doesn't know it.
Yeah.
he has no idea that I wrote it for him. But, you know, there's one in there, one on that album. I definitely hear Haggard sing. There's one I hear Marty Robbins sing. Both of those guys are dead and gone. I wrote one actually not too long ago with my son, which was awesome to write with my son for, hoping to get it to Chris Stapleton. So we'll see. That son of mine's kind of, he's got the big tour bus and he's ripping it across the country here in about a month. Actually, all three of them are very musical, and that's biggest joys of my life is playing with those guys.
Yeah. I came from also a musical family. My mother used to sing. Her father owned a movie studio, and she used to, years and years and years ago, they used to have commercials in between movies, for Chevy and Ford and Chrysler. And she used to sing the Chevy commercials.
Can you give us a rendition, Jim?
I have no idea what they sounded like. I've never seen one. All I've got is some pictures of it. But my dad played third clarinet with Benny Goodman when he was 17 years old.
Oh, wow.
Before he went in the Navy and during World War II. So the guy, he was just terribly musical. And my mom was, could sing like an angel. And my dad used to sit us down and play classical music and have us pick out the instruments. Right. That would be a Saturday afternoon fun time for us.
That's awesome.
You know, you pick out piccolo.
You know,
really learn to listen for instruments and know what they are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, when I was probably my 15th birthday, my stepfather got me the thing I loved the most right then. That point was Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony, the last movement, and it's got a big timpani part that comes in, and it's just right in your face, and it's real emotionally moving. And he bought me the mini score for that, and I used to sit there and just look at that score and follow along with that old 33
long LP. Yep.
And, you know, there's only two kinds of music, you know, the kind that affects you and the kind, and people who classify music, I have a real hard time with that. But anyway, there is nothing wrong with exposing people, including yourself, to just as many different genres, so-called genres, or
absolutely,
and whatever trips your trigger, man. You know,
I mean, I went through the surf music stuff. I mean, I had a surf band. I had a folk group. Then it went to a folk duo, and then I didn't do anything for a number of years, and then got back into music again, and started writing, and like much like you, I started just writing music. It hit me. It was time. There was enough under my belt at that point in my life that it was time to start writing.
You had something to write about. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I can sure relate to you.
Go ahead, Bobby.
I have another quick question. One of the essays is called The Hole in the Wall. And in this essay, you're going to make a presentation to writers that have come to hear you share your insight into the writing process. And knowing our audience here and that we also reach out to lots of new writers, I thought it might be interesting to have you. You don't necessarily need to read this from your book, but you stumbled around a little bit with what am I going to say to these folks? And then you knew what to say. Can you share a little bit about what you said to those authors?
Yeah, you know, first of all, the place where I was invited to give this talk is called The Hole in the Wall. It's on the southern end of the Bighorn Mountains in northern Wyoming. It's where Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and the Outlaws used to hole up. There's a large, and I mean 60-mile long, red sandstone wall that runs into some of the most beautiful country you've ever seen, north and south. And in the middle of that wall, there's a tiny little, almost a trail that you could get a horse through if you're real careful and real lucky. And that's where those guys used to slip in and out of. And the speakers group had me as a guest speaker down there trying to talk to their writers, at which time, this is a couple of years ago, and I hadn't really written any books or anything like that. And I didn't know what in the world I was going to talk to these writers about. And my talk took place down in the bottom of this canyon next to that red wall. And I stood underneath this cottonwood tree, just kind of trying to get my thoughts while they got quiet. And then they got real quiet and things got real quiet all around because I didn't have much to say. And I started to look across the canyon and saw that little hole in the wall, that little trail. And it dawned on me that I was standing in the clearing where Butch Cassidy's cabin was, and you could still see pilings for the corners where his bottom joists were, the logs for that cabin. And I started to think about that, where we were, and I told people basically to just open their ears and to look around and to start writing what came to their mind. The spirit was around us. I remember watching, I can't remember exactly what I said in the book. Here we go. Can I read a little bit?
Yeah, but we're running out of time. So,
okay.
I hate to rush you.
I told those folks to just keep their ears open and follow the wind and follow the magic that's in the air and they'd find something to write about. And I ended it, I just said, I drove off thinking about walls, words, and the holes that let one pass through the other. So, yeah.
Yeah, writing is like breathing.
It's out there.
Yeah.
Writing is like breathing, yeah.
So you're down in southern Arizona right now, is that correct?
I am right now, yes. Yep.
Where exactly are you in southern Arizona?
I'm about 20 miles north of the Sonora border, south of Tucson, about 40 miles, 30 miles.
Are you down by Bisbee?
No, I am west of Bisbee. I'm by a little place called Tubac.
Oh, I know Tubac.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
We had family in Sonoyta for a while.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, Anoint is right around the mountain.
Yeah, yep. Right around there. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, you know what, Dave? I hate to tell you this, but we're out of time. And it's been such a hoot having you. I mean, I love talking to musicians, number one. And number two, good writers. And you are both. My pleasure. Can you let our listeners know where they can reach you and your website and your email address?
Oh, I'd love to do that. Sure. My email address is Dave Muncik, MUNSICK @gmail.com.
Okay.
My webpage, which has all that information, is thesongteller.com. Just thesongteller.com. That'll get them to wherever they want. And they can listen, they can read, they can hear, they can get a hold of me, do whatever they want.
And you are down?
Books available there, and books available on Kindle, too, now.
Okay, and the name of your book is Songteller, Tales from the Road.
And
Notes from the Road. If you're interested in knowing what goes on in a musician's life on his off times and sometimes during his busy times, pick a copy of this book up. It's a wonderful, wonderful testament to a great writer and a great storyteller and a great songwriter. And thank you again, Dave, for joining us. And I hope you can come join us again sometime.
I'd love to. You guys take good care of yourselves out there and keep on the sunny side, all right?
Absolutely. and we'll talk soon, my friend.
Absolutely. Good night, you guys. It's been a pleasure.
Good night to you. And bye-bye. And, of course, I told you on the phone this afternoon that, of course, tomorrow is my COVID shots.
Yee-hee! Yes, yay!
Oh, my God. You know, the bookie is going crazy trying to figure out how to do this. And Idaho has had no vaccine. So it's like, oh. So anyway, next week we have a returning guest, Miss Catherine Hudson, will be back with us. And, of course, it's the first Thursday of March, which will bring back our good friend Henry Park. And he'll be joining us at the earliest part of the show. So it looks to be a great show next Thursday. And any announcements before we sign off there, Bobby, because we're like running out of time.
No, it's always a great day out west.
It is a great day out west. And we're getting snow tonight, so yippee-ki-yay.
Oh, not here.
Well, it'll be coming your way. Just gird your lungs. Okay. For Bobby Jean Bell, Jim Bell, of course, Ronan Rosner, Sam Hassan, myself, and of Russ, Mr. Russ Avison, who is probably not listening right now, and the Writer's Block and LA Talk Radio, we are out of here.